Open the Committee on Health, Water, and Environment, June 2nd. We have with us today legislators. We have a group that will be coming together on House Bill 3140. We'll hear them as soon as everyone's here. I think there's a little interest by a few legislators out of Washington County on that one. Let's start with Senate Bill 882. And Al, you bring with you who you want. Let's open a work session on Senate Bill 882.
Thank you. Al King, here, 44. And I bring to you the dash 5 amendments of Senate Bill 882. And I appreciate the time that the committee has given to me for this. The purpose of the dash 5 amendment for Senate Bill 882 is that it would allow for yurts to be used for potential homeless housing inside an urban growth boundary only. As we've talked before, yurts are effective and very low cost. I had also hoped to be able to include in the amendment the ability to allow yurts for migrant labor, but most farms are outside of the urban growth boundary, and so that's not going to be possible this year, and so I've just let that go to the side. That's an issue to be addressed in future legislative session. And so we're only dealing with attempts to help homeless housing inside the urban growth boundary. We have in the committee meetings before we read in the committee, we needed to make sure that the building codes issue were satisfied so the city felt comfortable. They did not have any liability. And it took some time to work out those amendments, which have been done now. But by the time we really get the amendments done, it was too late to be able to get on the calendar for that committee in time for the deadline of the closing of that committee. And so we lost the opportunity to be able to get the yurt bill done and my bill during this session. And I spoke with Senator Tarno, who, of course, also wisely had a yurt bill in the legislature, and I asked him if it would be possible to provide an amendment to his bill, and he graciously accepted it. And so, in order to be within the enabling clause, we needed to use the word campground for the yurt facilities that I had talked about, and so we've been able to satisfy that. But that also would mean that be able to satisfy that language and be able to work with migrant labor issues, we just want to have a good thing. So this does just deal with the homeless application, and now the cities and counties are satisfied with the bill, and we do have the building codes as well.
Questions from the committee?
Sure.
Deputy Merkel.
In the dash 5 amendments, which I think you're bringing forward today, aren't you?
Yes.
You have quite a different definition of yurt in the two sections dealing with Section 6 and Section 4.
Exactly. And there's a good explanation. Let me share that with you. If you'll go to Section 5, Section 5 basically builds a firewall between the first four sections, which pertain to the issues related to Senator Tarno's yurts for campgrounds. And Section 6 and beyond basically has to do with my provisions so that we can deal with the issues with respect to being inside a city or urban growth boundary. That was one of the issues we dealt with before. We didn't want to be able to have campgrounds of the kind that I was referring to going out into the ESU. In Timberlands areas, and at the same time, we didn't want to interfere with what Senator Tarno was trying to accomplish, and that the uses that he is looking for campgrounds, recreational campgrounds, those are already within land use code that allows the ESU in Timberlands.
Follow-up question, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
When you include plumbing in the definition of yurt, are you including sanitary facilities within the
We use the word mather. That certainly could be done. We would leave that to the discretion of the municipality and the operator. But at the same time, we didn't want to have that be required to be within the facility, because if we make them, as wonderful as they can be made, no one would move on to the next place. And we want to be able to provide for those in need, not those who want to stay perpetually.
So in the dash five, we still, we've gone through this a number of different times, and I want to make sure that we have what originally Senator Tarno was wanting, so I'm trying to figure out
exactly
that within dash five too.
No, he is
another.
He is one through four.
One through four.
His bill.
Right, with the dash incorporate.
Yeah. Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Okay, Murphy.
And I believe within the urban growth boundary, the campground could be 100% yurt, because that provision is really applying to the urban. Okay.
Mr. Chair, I have a question.
Murphy,
I'm on page 2 of the dash 5, section 6, and it appears to me that it's permissive in urban campgrounds to provide access to water, toilet, shower, laundry, and all those kinds of things. Was that your intent?
All right, we wanted to give some flexibility that this way we could have housing, but then with shared facilities, they could put plumbing, et cetera, inside of individualized yurts. But
this,
we also want to
make provide sure that access.
Yeah.
I'm on line 28 on page 2.
Exactly. What I was getting to next was that we could also have shared facilities, like we would see at a campground over on the coast, so that you wouldn't necessarily have a toilet or running water inside the yurt where you're staying, but you might, walk down the walkway or to a common shared facility and be able to use that, and that would be access that way also.
Do you have a follow-up in the future? Where in your amendments does it state that those kinds of services must be provided?
First of all, we're not requiring the cities, any municipality to do this. This would come with within their authorization. We would not be able to have any, kind of a campground without those kinds of those facilities. So we were leaving at the discretion of the operator, whether they did want to have something within the yurt itself or in the common facility. But they would have to have those kinds of uses there.
That's already required by law.
Go ahead and for the record.
Mr. Chair, my name is Patrick Lewis. I'm with the State Building Codes Division. And through the chair, the Representative Morgan, to answer your question, these provisions for health and safety, for cooking facilities, bathing facilities, and so forth, are already required in law by both the Building Codes Division and the Health Division. And so that's, I guess we felt that was a given, didn't need to be restated in this bill. But we left the option up to where they wanted to put those facilities, whether in the individual year or in a collective centralized location.
Then I guess I'm still confused, because it says the person establishing the accommodations may provide access to water, toilet, shower, laundry, cooking, telephone, or other services, either through separate or shared facilities. So am I interpreting this wrong, that I'm interpreting it that they don't have to provide those, but they may provide them?
Representative Morgan, it's my understanding, in terms of what was just said, that they have to provide it, but that what we're saying may here is that they may do it either way, in the individual facility or in the shared facility. But you would not be able to not provide those facilities.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a problem with the concept of putting transitional people on the outskirts. It's been my experience with homeless persons that they need to be in an area where there are some services with which they can work to get where they need to be. And so I don't actually understand the point of having to do this in a forest or a mixed common forest area.
It would not be in a forest or an EFU area. It would be within the urban growth boundary only, which then does make sure that we are close to services. But what happens in this is that we're not telling that municipality where within their boundaries they need to do it. We're giving them the flexibility of being able to do their own planning of whether they're in any part of their city. It's also true that we did want to make sure that, and we're giving preferences to this, so that they're close to bus lines or near grocery stores. These are kinds of things that need to be included. Currently, there is no homeless option of any sort, to my knowledge, in any city anywhere in the United States. To my knowledge, this is the only option, that it would come out to be something that would allow place legally to be where homeless people could come and have some local housing.
But as I understand also, if we still do it well within present law and allowing the municipality or the governing body there to make those decisions and what they need to establish according to state standards also.
Exactly. Well, they would have, if they wanted it in a residential area, an industrial area, a commercial area, any of those places, would be fine in terms of what the city has. And of course, they'd have to deal with their own issues in terms of, whose neighborhood it was or was not in.
A lot of regulation and loops to go through before they can establish it within governing jurisdiction.
If I could add something real quickly, a lot of times when we go out into the national forests and the campgrounds, we'll see a number of people who are homeless, who are staying there because they don't have other places to go, and then they tend to go from campground to campground. This hopefully would alleviate some of that pressure to give them a better alternative.
Mr. Chair.
Okay, Merkley.
Do I understand, Representative, that there wouldn't be, there's no limit in this law on the size of this campground within the urban growth boundary?
That's a correct statement.
Any other questions?
My understanding also is that there's no limit on the size of what the yurt could be either.
Through the chair to Representative Morgan, there are restrictions within the building codes on fabric structures that limit the size of them.
What are they?
I really don't know. I don't have that code with me. I'm afraid I can't answer it.
And I did have that discussion, and I believe that the maximum it would be 20 feet, but it could be 16 feet. The most common majority is 16 feet. These might be smaller. And that would be for the residential portions. The manufacturer in Cottage Grove makes a 30-foot version, but that would not be appropriate for a housing option here, and is excluded from the building codes aspect of that. But that could be an option for the shared facility where you might put the showers or others. You could use a traditional stick-built structure or other kind of structure, or you could use a yurt as an alternative for that as well.
Any other questions? Thank you very much. What I'd like to do is run this again on Friday. We just got these real late last night. We'll see these ready and get a clarification on what the original sponsor wanted, Senator Tarno. I'll run this to you on Friday. We'll close the work session on Senate Bill 882. And let us open a hearing on House Bill 3130. And those? representatives that are here would like to come forward and talk about this.
Come up. Let's see. Let's go.
This bill that's been submitted without any attention at all. You would
I don't see my file. There's nothing in here.
Legislators would bring that to our attention.
Welcome. Thank you. Mr. Chairman, my name is Representative Max Williams. I represent House District 9, which is entirely in Washington County, and we thank you and the committee for this late-date scheduling hearing on this bill. With me today is Representative Scharr, who will have his own conference, and I'd like, if you would join us here up front, former State Representative Tom Bryant and now current Chairman of the Washington County Commission.
Welcome, Commissioner.
Who's here to discuss what's a very important issue for Washington County. What many of you might not know, and something that frankly I didn't know until I got into this process, was that Washington County, despite having a population in excess of 400,000 people, has no state park with overnight camping facilities. You'll hear from the Parks Division today that we have 650 acres of parkland in Washington County, but it's about, I don't know, maybe 40 feet wide on both sides of the old stretch of railroad track that runs through the county, and it's a linear park. Very nice thing, and I'm not casting aspersions at the linear park, but it's tough to camp there. In fact, they don't allow any overnight camping. There's a great need in Washington County for an overnight camping and park facility. And I know the Parks Commission on several occasions has made some efforts there and have always come up short. But I think the time is now right for some additional efforts to be made towards an overnight camping facility in Washington County to serve those 400,000 residents who, frankly, either have to head over to the coast or have to head towards the Cascade Range before they really can find overnight camping facilities. This is an important issue for folks in our district who feel the need, especially with the kind of congestion and traffic problems that we have in that area, to provide some overnight camping facilities for weekend camping that otherwise I think is more difficult for residents in Washington County. There are a lot of good reasons why a suitable state park with camping facilities should be located in Washington County. I'm going to have Representative Scharr and then Chairman Bryan address some of those.
Thanks. For the record, State Representative Bruce Scharr. I represent most of rural western Washington County where one of these potential park sites could be located. And western Washington County is a beautiful area, a place that would lend itself greatly to an overnight campground facility. We've got agriculture, we've got forestry, we've got rivers, we've got an abundance of natural resources there that I think would lend itself to Washington County. As Representative Williams said, we have a population of over 400,000 people. I think if we developed a site in Washington County, it would be used heavily, it would be used near immediately. I see a great need there. I would like to see you to move this bill forward. We'd like to move ways to meet so that we can continue this discussion. Work cooperatively with the Parks Commission to identify the park site and get it developed as quickly as possible. So I'd just like to second the comments that Representative Williams made and urge your favorable action on House Bill 3140.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. My name is Tom Bryan. I'm Chairman of the Washington County Board of Commissioners in Hooper, Oregon. And I appreciate very much the opportunity to speak to this and the fact that you've given us a hearing, and very much appreciate the Washington County delegation for moving this to this point. Washington County as a board and the neighborhood groups and so forth that I work closely with are very excited about a prospect for a state park in Washington County. As has been mentioned, there are no camping beds in Washington County, and it's really been fun the last 5 months of my service to get to know Washington County even better, because most people think of Washington County as a densely populated suburb, when in fact, east of Forest Grove and Hillsboro, more than half of the county lies out to the west side, and it's heavily timbered with beautiful water resource and some beautiful prospects for a state park. It's located roughly halfway between the coast and the Portland metropolitan area, which would be very convenient for just hundreds of thousands of people of all ages and for camping, reduce coastal traffic, reduce pressure on the coastal parks. It would be very convenient for school and church field trips and everything else for day use. So it's really a great opportunity. We've appreciated the cooperation of the state park. We realize we don't have a site specific. There are some contenders, and we have a lot more work to do there. But without a doubt, we've got the area and a lot of natural features to look for. I, too, would urge you to approve this measure and to send it to Ways and Means. There are a lot of issues, obviously funding. There are options that have been kicked around for the last 3 or 4 months. And I guess by sending it to Ways and Means, it keeps the option alive of discussing it and see what falls out late in the session. So we would look forward to working with members in Ways and Means, the State Parks Department, to try to keep this moving. We've made good progress raising the visibility of this issue. And whether it's study money or money set aside to the e-board after a site's identified by the Parks Commission, any of those things will be great for us, and we'll be happy to discuss those in Ways and Means. Just finally want to mention the complete commitment of the county's resources to work with the Parks Department. We are willing to make staff available and incur some of the costs. We also have some options that we're discussing with some of the timber companies in Washington County and other folks about matching money and perhaps donated land contiguous to possible site locations. So we're excited about it and hope this will allow us this opportunity to keep the discussion going in Ways and Means.
Questions from the committee? Mr. Chairman, if I might just comment, too, in regards to park sites in Washington County, during a prior life when I was on the Metro Council and chaired, I think, virtually every committee that dealt with the Green Spaces program, and we inventoried potential park sites in the metropolitan area, and actually also looked outside Metro's boundaries in Washington and Clackamas counties. Our difficulty was in narrowing our list of possibilities, because there were literally countless possibilities in Washington County, in the Tillamook Burn area, in along the Tualatin River, Gales Creek, just numerous opportunities. This is not actually an example that's in Washington County. It's just outside of Washington County, but I can tell you some of the difficulties in the past. I'm very supportive of state parks, but some of the difficulties in the past, I hate to bring this up, but near the damaged site, there's a 200-acre parcel that's in Clackamas County that, became available. General Services for the state basically wanted to get rid of it. We tried to get state parks to take it for the administrative cost of taking it, which was 200 acres directly outside the urban growth boundary for an administrative cost of about $75,000 or $80,000 total cost. They wouldn't do it. So we got it transferred to the Division of State Land. That's one of the difficulties in the sense that state parks has never particularly been, and I understand due to their limitations on operating funds, in the last 10 or 15, 20 years, has never been particularly receptive to expanding their facilities, particularly given the expanding population we have and the expanding amount of tourism, which is very, very unfortunate. I think there are plenty of opportunities in Washington County, and I'm sure that the county would be willing to work in partnership in finding those opportunities.
I need to ask what efforts the county has made on behalf to establish an overnight camping park.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Taylor, I'm not an expert on that, having been there 5 months. We have Hag Lake that's owned by the Federal Bureau of Reclamation, and they specifically bar overnight camping. We've worked with us to try to allow camping there, and it's a pretty firm no. I don't believe the county historically has gone the route of a county park. We don't have any. It's just not been part of I don't know what you call it, culture or something. I don't know why not. I don't know why not. And we've thought about it in the last few months, but it seems to me that to find the right facility, the right area, the right size, and do the right job with it, it's more than we can probably afford, and we are better off putting resources in as a partner and giving it to the state. Anything we put into this will belong to the state. We're willing to put some considerable effort into that. And I think it increases our chances of ultimately reaching the prize if we can provide some match. So I guess that's the answer.
Let's think before. Let me get this straight, Selma. I think I have a little bit of a hiccup. Are we talking about having camping in Beaverton?
No. Mr. Chairman, Representative Atkinson, this probably gets back to the previous testimony. So we do have some homeless camping there, but no. I mean, and that's really my point. And I'd love to arrange a Saturday tour, probably after the session for you, but. Really, you know, I mean, it's amazing that of our 400,000 people, 90% of them are from the Hillsborough, Forest Grove area east. And then we have this huge western, probably 55-60% of our geography that's very lowly populated.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, I'd just like to let the Representative Atkinson know that anytime he wants to come up to the metro area, you're welcome to pitch your tent in my front yard.
Follow up.
You know, gentlemen, I have stacks of mail. Stacks. Showing that it would be cheaper to build this park in Umatilla. Do you care to comment?
There was another bill.
I don't think I'm going to touch that with Mr. Chairman.
Let's think of course.
So if Senate Bill 882 passes, are we going to have years for this campground in Washington?
I'm open to that.
Yeah, I'm open to that.
Yeah, it's quite possible. Those are, I think, Mr. Chairman, President Gordon, I've used those. That's a great middle ground. When you get old like I am, you start off camping on the ground, you see the folks drive by in the big RVs, and you go, boy, those would be terrible. When you get to be 50, you go, microwave, huh? But in between, you've got all these stages of camping, and that's what we need to accommodate at these parks.
Other questions? Good morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Have you entered into any kind of a dialogue with the State Park Department over time about the process involved here and tried to isolate some sites with them? I mean, this is what it appears that you're coming in with here is a very short time frame that a park must be put on the ground by January 1st, 2000. And now I'm real concerned what kind of legwork you've done on this and where you are in the process.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Morgan, specifically and recently, we've engaged in a dialogue with Park Department since January, and we've taken the approach that, first of all, we've been extremely pleased by the our delegation's support for State Park, and we've also told the State Parks Commission this is a partnership. You know, we're not interested in a super siting per se or anything like that. We want to work with them. It's their park when they're finished. But we want to. We realize resources are tight, so to the extent we can assist in the search and even the development of the park, we want to talk about that. Our contacts with some of the owners in the county and so forth, and potentially donated space. I suspect, frankly, in ways and means, it's kind of wide open there what result might be in ways and means. Everything from nothing to some assistance with money to. Study because it does cost money to really do a thorough search and do some environmental impact work and so forth. So we've done some legwork. Frankly, this is something that I've kind of tried to instigate in the county and push onto our agenda. So frankly, there hasn't been a lot of work done since up until January, and then the last 4 or 5 months, you know, our board has adopted it as a priority, and we're gearing up quickly. I don't have, you know, an argument with the time frame or the moving of the time frame. The key thing is that we start working together to decide apart.
One of the other issues that's concerning of me here, too, is that when I hear you talking about the sites that you've considered for parks, I hear prime ag and prime forest land. How do you address those issues of taking that land out of the resource land base?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Morgan, I suspect the State Parks Commission has a variety of rules and policies on that, and we'll be governed by those. We've talked to some of the timber owners, for example. They do have concerns if you try to put a state park surrounded by harvestable timber. They're worried about what ripple effect that has on them. We'll have to work with that issue. I suspect this would not be prime farm ground because prime farm ground doesn't have any trees on it typically, and we would want some at least scattered trees. Those are issues that have to be taken care of in the siting process, as in any park site.
Yeah.
And,
my question is, the State Park Recreation Commission to acquire the park by January 1st, 2000. Is the date there in order to take advantage of the Measure 66 funds before they're all used or taken or spoken for?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gino, I don't necessarily think that was our intent as we developed this bill. Obviously, it is, I think, Chairman Brian mentioned that, it's our intent, and we're flexible on that date. The purpose of this bill, frankly, was to build a fire under the Parks Commission and the Parks Department to move forward with finding a site for a park in Washington County. We just yesterday, we passed a bill directing the development of a plan to create a park at Chrissy Field in southern Oregon, on the southern Oregon coast. And the reason that bill got to the floor, if you ask Representative Messerly, was to require the Parks Department and the Parks Commission to essentially develop a plan and mandate a plan for including that as a state park. The Washington County delegation simply wants to have a vehicle that gets a clear message to the Parks Commission and the Parks Department that we have 400,000 residents that need a place to go camping on the weekend, and that, you know, we're left out. Our county doesn't have an overnight camping facility. We don't want to supersite the park. We want to go through the normal process, but we want some direction on this thing. And frankly, we want at least a shot at going down to Ways and Means and trying to knock the ball out of the park. And if we only get to first base, we'll take a single. And that may just be enough money to do a siting plan and design, and then we'll have to find another way to fund it through MASH or some other kind of a deal. But that's the intent of this bill. So I asked the committee to give us our shot, both to go down to Ways and Means, and let us go down there and try to scrap the thing out.
All the counties I represent have no state parks. It has county parks, which they have a struggle to keep going, but they're nice. We have good state park sites also along Columbia River. But the reason they're seeking the park, they're trying to keep their parks going, is because as a region they have tourism as one of their economic development goals. Now, I don't think that's the same reason you come here from Washington County. It's not a part of your overall plan for economic development. It's rather to provide recreational opportunity for those persons who are already there employed. So my question is, how does this proposal for a state park fit into your overall plan in your county?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Taylor, it is also part of the economic diversity of the area. First of all, it's going to be the closest state camping park to the Portland metropolitan area. The Washington County Visitors Association is extremely excited and have been pushing for a park and some camping in Washington County. It will serve both. It will serve local needs, but also being halfway between the coast and the Portland area, I think it will be heavily used by the tourists. And I think part of the interest of the Parks Department is that it will provide some relief through the reservation system and so forth. It will provide some relief to the coastal park campgrounds. One of our interests in it being a state park is to plug it in to the state promotions, the state reservation system as a convenience to the public, rather than trying to reinvent. You know, we don't do parks. To create a department within the county, and that hasn't been something we've done previously. It seems a lot more efficient to work with the state to develop it and have it be a part of the state reservation system.
I see it as environmentally and economically friendly also, and the fact that miles traveled to find a state park are much more extreme now for those that population going to the coast or trying to find one. And reduce that travel, day use or on weekends even by a large population.
And Mr. Chairman, I'd like to comment on it. It's exactly correct. We think not only will it reduce our Highway 18 and 26 traffic is getting, it's just a parade. You get in line and just drive. The other thing that we're missing, especially with education finance and so forth, the kids are not within striking distance of a state park for day use or school trips or nature trails or any of that stuff. We just think it would the day use function for all kinds of uses, everything from company gatherings to reunions to school and church day use, but also the fact that you're putting a state park within a half hour to an hour of a million people. Instead of driving 2.5-3 hours to Central Oregon or to the coast and putting additional burdens on already overburdened campsites.
All right. Representative Hill, would you like to?
Chair, for the record, my name is Representative Jim Hill. I represent District 5, which is Hillsborough, Cornelius, and Fortsborough. Representative district goes from the around mine and western Washington County. Mr. Chair, just briefly, I want to add my voice to those Washington County legislators who are here seeking, redress of what we think is an oversight. And to address specifically Representative Gianella's question in terms of I was actively involved in drafting the measure. I think my philosophy is you ask for what you want, and then you can always amend it back in there, and a date certain. Is always a nice thing because it has to be done by a certain. But I'm also realistic in this process and understand how the budget constraints are, and I would concede with my colleague from the Tigard area that give us an opportunity to hash this out down the ridge and see if it is possible. Because I think for all we have land use issues, we've protected the farmland, we've got in Western Washington, we've got wonderful areas in terms of timber. We've got water resources out there in terms of, I think you can create an appropriate park in terms of that will be in and of itself a reason for people to go there. And I think in terms of adding recreational benefits and resources within the metro area, I don't think it's going to be detrimental to see the augmenting, I think, already a strong park system. And I think in terms of with the leadership of Ryan from Washington County, I think we can work collectively and think of an appropriate location, appropriate site, and develop something I think that will benefit all of us.
Mr. Chair?
Are
we in a work session?
Not yet.
Okay.
I would like to have allow Parks an opportunity to talk to this. If there's no further questions, I sure appreciate your time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And the chair's motion is to move this away from me, so we'll get to that, but we want to talk about it here real quick, okay?
Jim Lockwood.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm glad somebody else brought up prison siting because I know that you as legislators are all sensitive to constituent phone calls. And the one constituent group that has come to me and said they'd like a park has been the people around the Day Road alternative site just inside Washington County. And I still have, for my days representing corrections and prison siting, my personal map of the area that has the Day Road site marked in Washington County if anybody needs to borrow a Washington County map. I'm Jim Lockwood, Government Relations Manager, Oregon Parks and Recreation Department. Thanks for the opportunity to comment on House Bill 3140. I will try to be brief because I sense some desire to move on the part of the committee. Just to state right up front, the comment was made that recommending the bill needs to be moved to Ways and Means for further discussion. We have no trouble with that at all. We've had great discussions with both some of the Washington County delegation meetings as well as Commissioner Bryan and other folks from Washington County. So we, as you will see, there's a report here from a 1988 look in Washington County. We have spent some time this year looking a little bit more, and of course, if the legislature directs, we'll be more intense about that. So what I'd like to do is bring up a couple of specific points. Number one is my obligatory comment that with Thompson's Mills, this, the Dive Park, any of those bills, Chrissy Field, we respectfully suggest that the State Parks and Recreation Commission be asked to fulfill its legal responsibility and weigh those options wherever they are. I don't mean any of these points to take away from Washington County Parks. We just have to say that we really think the Parks Commission ought to weigh the relative merits. It's pretty tough when you weigh the merits of the different programs. Measure 66 has brought a number of ideas out of the woodwork or possibilities, and it's neat to be sought after, fought over as an opportunity for people. So we like that. We like what we're the pressure we're under, but it's tough to make the decision. A couple of points. Chrissy Field, we already own the property. We have a South Coast Master Plan draft already done. All the Chrissy Field bill would do is direct us toward making a park-specific plan in one part of an area we've already mastered. So we didn't have any problems with that because that's what we're going to do anyway. Then to kind of back up what Representative Devlin and some others have said, just a point on the parkland in Washington County. We have 665 acres. I outline it here at the top of the second page of my testimony. In no way do I want to suggest that these parklands we own are what people normally think of as a state park. So I own up to that right there. But we do have the property, and I had to just say it. So another obligatory thing to list out what we do have there. And then the third point is, in making some of those tough choices, what I did was, and there's different ways to look at what's a great state park. There really are, because some of them are historic, some of them are camping-oriented, some of them are natural feature-oriented. But what I did was, I thought, because the Washington County folks thought that camping was kind of a key piece of this, and there are different ideas on what they'd like, but I thought, well, I would go ahead and list out what counties have the campgrounds in the state parks. We don't always own the campground. Detroit Lake State Park is a good example. We lease it to the Army Corps of Engineers. We run it because we know the public would like to use it. So there are other examples there. In some cases, we own the land, and a county takes it from us. We're the owners, but we let them use it as a county park. So there's a lot of cooperative work going on, and we foresee the same kind of thing happening with Washington County. Probably the biggest challenge at the moment that people would think is funding. Actually, we go through the county master planning process, and it really comes down to where is it that folks really want the park, the nature of it, how big, if it's a Silver Falls-style park, we're talking thousands of acres, other parks are much smaller. So what is it that, you know, how much will the local, the businesses, the MTELs, and the others up there be willing to chip in and really bring the community of Washington County together and say, here's something we'd be proud of. Here's what would serve all Oregonians, but fit in our county best, that type of thing. A lot of talk is required to bring that about, but that's just to give you a little bit of an overview. I wanted to kind of clarify a few things, but also say that we're happy to keep talking as we are on many of the other ideas that have come forward. So it's an opportunity. We look forward to discussing it further.
President Morgan.
Thank you for your testimony. That was really interesting. Has Washington County approached the State Parks Department about entering into a process to master plan the county?
Well, we have, Representative, Chairman Welch, Representative Morgan, didn't promote her. That has been one of the many things we've talked about. We've talked about all kinds of ideas, like what to do first in a sense, which is, well, what kind of park? What would it be, camping or not? Because some people thought, well, maybe not, or maybe so, maybe a conference center, any combination of things. And so I think probably the next thing that we would talk about is some of the steps in that master plan process that we would need to go through, because obviously, since we don't do superspending the way the prison process works, we work through that local process. As arduous as it is, it does bring all of us on board on the same track and has a lot of public involvement. So that's kind of what we'll be talking about next. We haven't really gotten into any of the planning at all.
Yes.
In your opinion, is the master planning process the appropriate place to start, or well, kind of hearing that the process may be even further back from that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, there are lots of opinions on it. I'll give you kind of my spin, and that is that, and I think maybe you legislators can kind of sense this from your experience. Sometimes it's easier to plan or to move forward, to get funding, anything, when you've got some folks that kind of have an idea of where they want to go and what they want to have there. And the more crystallized that is, everybody wants a state park. And that's kind of easy for people to get on board with. It's kind of like everybody wants a prison. And so, you mean this one here, and, you know, and parks are the same way sometimes. They're not as threatening unless you live there and it takes your land or whatever it is. And so the ability for people to kind of gel on an idea, I think sometimes is helped when people have scoped out the land, really narrowed down the options and say, hey, let's kind of put one of these out there or a couple of them out there and as trial balloons and see what kind of reaction we get. See if people seem to rally for it, talk it around the private corporations that might chip in to sponsor a campground or a conference center or whatever, a visitor center, and kind of feel people out in the process rather than first going into the formal process. I think sometimes it takes that informal feeling out the community. And, of course, the Washington County Commissioners and others locally there, delegation here from there are much more in tune with that populace than we are. If we come in and say we're from Salem and we're here to help you with this formal planning process, you can feel people shrink back sometimes. And so we really want to follow their lead on what is it you're talking about. And that's why we've had a lot of discussions with them to kind of try to get a feel for that. Just where are you coming from? What are you envisioning? Don't necessarily think small. If the Silver Falls type thing is the concept that you really are thinking. Tell us where you're at.
Can I have one more thought? The bill gives a 6-month time frame to have this be a done deal. Can you give a more realistic estimate of how long you think this process would take?
Typically, well, not to have a park on the ground and running, but to have it, let's say, before breaking ground kind of thing. More realistic would be in a couple of years. And that would not vary a whole lot by area or anything. That's unless there's some site developed or some peculiarity with some situation. But normally, to walk through that process and really do it in an open, deliberate fashion, a park of any size. Now, if somebody comes along, you never know. If some timber baron or somebody else comes along and says, county, you know, I want to work with you in state parks, and here's all this land. I only have these conditions, and if the neighbors don't create a fear, you know, there are conditions where it could move more quickly. I respect Representative Hill's perspective, though. Sometimes you kind of need to have a date to get people's attention, and I don't agree with the date. He probably wouldn't either assign that, but I can see why. Have that. Most bills that have dates like that, we end up Christie Field Bill, as I'm sure Representative Devlin was aware of, didn't have a date in it. And Senator Tarnow knew what he was doing on that, because the fiscal impact wasn't there either. So if you don't have the date, you don't have to do it this next minute. You can spread it out over time. So there's different approaches.
Thank you.
Okay, Gino.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Lockwood, did you say that you have 665 acres in Washington County of parkland?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gianella, that's correct. That parkland is in, as you can see, different places. One of them was a rail to trail, like a former railroad track. That's where they talk about it being very narrow and long. The Banks Vernonia State Park is kind of like this long strip along a railroad track, and isn't readily amenable to having a campground added or other facilities. And then other ones like the Sunset Highway Forest Wayside is, if you can picture Van Duzer Corridor down here on the way to the coast, it's more of that strip along the highway of beautification park, and then so on. So these tend to be rather limited and not usually a person's concept of a state park in a typical way.
Out of the 665 acres, how many acres do you think are usable?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gianella, for campground, probably about none. For this type of park, probably very little, although I have to admit I'm not personally familiar with each little piece, but I would say that most people would say there'd have to be a major addition somewhere around one of these to make it a viable kind of multi-use park where there's recreational areas as well as campgrounds.
I have two more quick questions. One, how many acres does Champlain Park have? Do you know?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wells, I have forgotten. I've known, but it escapes me. I can add in one little thing. Silver Falls is 8,700 or something thereabouts, just to give you from this area concept.
And then, how many acres does it take for an overnight campground? What's an average?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gianella, I don't have an average in my head. It usually takes what we go on one assumption, and that is you can have a couple of hundred acres that actually is the campground with the facilities and the driveways and so on. But the one assumption we try to build in is that any neighborhood or business or whatever would naturally also like a buffer around it so that they don't have a motorhome over the fence to their operation or their property, whatever it is. So we're talking probably of anything of the magnitude I've kind of got a sense of, that it would be a minimum of several hundred acres, if not several thousand. And I think sometimes the bigger dreams, the things like Silver Falls State Park and so on, actually can attract donations and from foundations or corporations and so on because of that they can envision the conference center for the private industry could use there in the coastal range or whatever. They can start to see something really big other than the local park along the highway. So
one
final
question. Yes, one final question. Minimum of several hundred acres. What is several?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Gianella, it depends on that. That's the kind of thing we haven't narrowed down yet. If it's in an area that would have some nature trails or might have some water activities, if it's along the Tualatin River or something like that, I could see it easily being 400 to 4,000 acres. We're talking so generally now, it's hard for me, from outside the county, to kind of lay some limits on the legislators, the commissioners, the citizens, and so on. We like to see some of this arise from within the community, and so it could easily range from 400 to 4,000. And that's just from the discussions we've had.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair? I'm not sure that this is a question that you can answer. So if we were to send this bill to the Ways and Means process, there really wouldn't be a way to get a handle on what the scope of it was cost-wise either.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Morgan, the part of our planning process does that. It helps narrow down what kind of activities would occur there. And those kind of activities range from scuba diving underwater to parasailing. There's a full range of kind of things that go on at State Park, rock climbing and so on. And the entering into a planning process helps us define what, where, how much, the Representative Gianella's questions, those kinds of things. The specifics within that are the kind of cost factors involved in terms of getting, if somebody donated a lot of land but you didn't have a road anywhere near it, getting people there, all those help plan and cost out what it would be. It's conceivable, and I don't want to speak for the folks that are suggesting it go to Ways and Means, because that's not my formal suggestion. I think it's a reasonable one, though, but the Ways and Means folks, as we and others discuss it, could perhaps suggest that planning money be put into this or what have you to get those factors down, even if no particular site was purchased. Sometimes we have people come to us in the Parks Department and offer to sell land at a certain price, or the Trust for Public Lands will have somebody make sell an option to purchase for a period of time. There's all kinds of ways these things happen, and it's conceivable that Ways and Means can fund some of that initial planning and development.
May I have a follow-up? If the decision of the committee was to enter into the planning process with the county and begin that, would that be something that would be, the cost of that would be included in your existing budget, or would that require an increase?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Morgan, that can vary. The existing budget is about ready to go to the House floor, so assuming that were the budget to go through, has some acquisition funds in it. If some of those were used for the purpose of planning, then that's one of the things the commission weighs. It's on all the different ideas that come along, the Thompson's Mills, the Washington County, and so on. Just kind of where to put the resources in terms of moving off into an acquisition of additional properties as opposed to the repair of what we already have.
Very good. Okay, let's close the hearing on House Bill 3170. I'm going to open the work session of House Bill 3170, and the chair would like to move this to Ways and Means. Do we have any discussion? Representative Morgan.
I was wondering if the committee would be open to deleting the January 1, 2000 part of this in the emergency clause, Section 3 and 4, out of the bill before we move it on.
That's Ways and Means. I would prefer that they consider that.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I think that was the intention. I should put it over there. That didn't work out those details if you don't mind. Please.
Chairman.
Sure. GNL.
I move House Bill 3140 to Ways and Means to do pass recommendation.
I made that motion.
Okay.
We're already in discussion mode. Now I'm ready to see if there's any opposition. No. Opposition. Okay. Will the clerk please call the roll then?
Representative
Cruz, Representative Atkinson, Ben Lindsay. Here. I'll
have
the others excused, please.
President
Janella?
Here.
Aye. President Ford? Excuse. President Morgan? Aye. President Taylor?
No.
Chair Wells? Aye. And the required number of votes? House Bill 3140 passed on the way to me. Close the work session on House Bill 3140. Okay, let's open a work session on Senate Bill 85. Mr. Cross. Rick Williams. Economic Coalition. And with me is Rick Williams, who also is part of their organization. And I'll let Rick speak to you on the what we'd actually like to address would be the Dash 7, A7 amendment. Because it basically, the A7, as you saw it originally come over from the Senate, would be, that language would be completely altered by the Dash 7. And the Dash 7 are a result of several meetings with the governor's office, LCDC, EDD, the City of Portland, Thousand Friends, the Board of Cities, the Association of Board of Counties, in trying to reformat and address the initial concerns in the bill, but try and address some of the issues that were raised, both in the Senate and by some of those organizations, of how the bill could actually be implemented. So I'll let Rick explain some of the more significant changes in the proposal.
Thanks, Bill. Chair Welsh, committee members, thanks for the opportunity to come present to you today. Again, my name is Rick Williams. I'm a member of the Commercial Real Estate Economic Coalition. I'm an employee of Melvin Mark Companies in Portland, Oregon, a management firm, commercial properties management firm in Portland. Real quickly, I just wanted to reacquaint you with the purpose of Senate Bill 87. We believe it's a bill that helps ensure sound planning in the future in jurisdictions of 25,000 in population or greater. It would require those jurisdictions to track and inventory the supply of land within their urban growth boundaries for employment-related development. This type of information that they would gather through this process would be used in their comprehensive land use plan review process to assure that adequate land to fulfill their desired, and that's an important word, the local government's desired economic development objectives are included in their 20-year plan. As Bill mentioned, we've had a work group put together since the bill came out of the Senate. It's been a good work group. We've met four or five times now. We appreciate the participation of everybody in the work group because I think the bill is a better bill as a result of that. Again, good planning requires good information. Good planning requires that jobs and housing are balanced so that we have efficient uses of land within our urban growth boundaries. I want to walk you through some of the concerns that were originally expressed with the bill and then note the changes that occurred through the work group in trying to address those concerns. The very first concern that was addressed when the bill came out of the Senate was how data actually was collected. There was a concern that we were locking jurisdictions into a five-year horizon. In other words, their forecast might reflect a hot market and therefore overestimate the land supply need, or in the future it could be reflective of a slow market and underestimate the land needs. We've significantly modified that language. You'll note it on page 1 of the A7, lines 16 through 19. The forecast shall be based on an analysis of national, state, local economic development trends and local economic development objectives. This gives jurisdictions a great deal of flexibility to use information that's available to them, and it also gives them the opportunity to make changes or take into account trends that are occurring currently and in other jurisdictions and in other areas of the country. The second concern that was expressed about the bill was the timing of when this bill would take effect. We addressed that in sections 3, 4, 5 of the bill that puts this into effect for Metro and the Portland metropolitan area beginning October 1st of this year, which is something that Metro is comfortable with. Our organization is actually working with Metro as we speak on gathering this type of information for the uses in the Portland metropolitan area. But it gives those other jurisdictions above 25,000 outside of the metropolitan area in Portland until December 31st of 2000, which allows DLCD to go into rulemaking and clarify some concerns that those jurisdictions have. Another concern that was addressed is really the hierarchy of decision-making that would occur as jurisdictions evaluate their land supply and their inventories. there was a concern that this bill was an attempt to blow the urban growth boundary. As some people said, it was a land-gobbling folly. It's totally not the case. But to address that need, you'll notice on section on page 2, lines 24 through 30, section 5, that the first order of decision-making in the hierarchy in priority order is that jurisdictions would demonstrably increase the likelihood that forecasted retail office and industrial development can be accommodated within the urban growth boundary. Goal 9 actually has provisions and recommendations within it that would call in for jurisdictions to look at tax incentives, to look at other measures available that they could implement within their own codes to assure that the type of development they want to occur and the type of job growth that they want to occur will happen. And the first order of business to do that is within the urban growth boundary itself. Barring that, the next order of business would be to look at urban growth boundary expansions if necessary. But again, that's the last resort, and we think we dealt with that in the revisions to this bill. Finally, overall, we believe that the intent of the bill is to assure an efficient use of land. You'll notice on page 2, lines 10 through 14, we have language in the bill that would require jurisdictions to assure that industrial office and retail development uses land and infrastructure investments efficiently, that these types of uses be located and designed to allow transportation options for employees and customers so that we don't have people living in one jurisdiction and having to drive to another jurisdiction for their job. This is an efficient use of land. We also want to make sure that mixed-use development occurs, the mixed retail office and industrial development with other uses for compact form, and again, looking at the best use of land within urban growth boundaries, and then any other relevant factors that those local jurisdictions believe are important to their planning process. In summary, I would just state that we believe that this is a good bill. Again, good planning requires good information, and this bill requires that that happen. Goal 9 gives us direction. This bill simply assures that it does happen and that it is balanced with other statewide planning goals for housing, for transportation, and for jobs, and for compact urban development. With that, we would urge your support of the bill, and I thank you for your time.
Bill? Mr. Chairman, committee members, we have talked with several of the parties, and they're on the dash A7s, and I would like to actually make copies, but we identified two technical changes on page 3. In line 25, changing reference to subsection 6 to subsection 7, and on line 30, deleting the last ORS 197.717. In addition, we have a change on line 20 of page 1, deleting the phrase, the sizes, types, and locations of retail, office, and industrial, and replacing that with suitable. So it would read, a local government shall determine suitable land needed. And because then in the subsection, later in that section, we do refer back to the rule on page 2, lines 5 to 7, which refers to existing language about identifying size and types and locations. And that would be one means of trying to identify what would be adequate or suitable land necessary for protecting your growth. The last change is page 4, subsection 4. There's when we talk about the effective date for Metropolitan Service District, and we would like to ask that language be added in Metropolitan Service District undergoing a legislative review of its urban growth boundary or a periodic review pursuant to the remaining sections. That would pick up the actual circumstances that Metro is in right now, where they're conducting this review as part of their review of their urban growth plans, so it should make it effective.
That does address some other concerns.
Two questions. One, just a definitional. I think I have an idea what this term means, but I'm not sure I do. Retail floor area ratio. What does it mean?
Chair Welsh, Representative Devlin. It's an industry term for retail floor area
ratios is a coverage estimate. You'll buy a piece of land, and then the amount of building that covers that site, as opposed to areas of the site that are non-building use.
So it's like 40% of
the floor area. Yeah, some jurisdictions then might look at minimum requirements for floor area, maximum requirements for floor area, et cetera.
Second question.
Yes, follow up.
In Metro's case, have you, because they would have authority to do this, and I think they indicated that during their last periodic review or of urban growth boundary, they did do a lot of this work in your testimony. It would seem that they could incorporate what you want in the metropolitan area within their functional plans. Have they done that, or have you attempted to get them to do that?
Chair Welsh, Representative Devlin, in the last go-around, Metro estimated total employment as an aggregate and then assigned that to an aggregate of vacant land. And we've been working with them since then to be more detailed as it relates to the requirements of Goal 9. Metro can do this. I believe, as we said, we're working with them to do that. The next piece of this bill, though, that's important to recognize is that once those benchmarks are established, Senate Bill 87 then requires that the next legislative review or periodic review, that there's a check-in process that occurs so that the assumptions that went into estimating employment and the assumptions that went into estimating the land supply are actually reevaluated. And then you'll notice later on, so did we meet our target goals? Why or why not? If yes, we go on. If no, you have the opportunity to then evaluate new performance standards, new trends, and make new estimates. But the importance of this is, one, to establish the benchmark, and then, two, require the check-in so that the next periodic review is consistent with the one that preceded it.
Final question, Mr. Chairman. Do you foresee, well, I'm not as familiar with other metropolitan areas in the state, but in the metropolitan area, do you see somewhat of a tug-of-war going on in terms of retail expectations? I mean, we build a lot of big box development, but most jurisdictions are starting to go in a direction of trying to discourage big box development. Do you see that happening, I mean, with this terminology here?
Chair Welsh, Representative Devlin, this terminology does not preclude it, nor does it encourage it. That is a decision that's made at the local level, and I think, again, this bill allows that flexibility to occur. Some jurisdictions are actually looking at those retail restrictions. Our organization, of course, as you might suspect, doesn't necessarily support those, and we've testified in those local jurisdictions. But in their planning processes, they can do that. What we would ask, though, is, again, this bill would say that your retail employment projections are established, performance standards are put in place to track them, and if you're not meeting them, the corrective measures are taken to make sure that they do.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Thank you. Can we go back to the basic needs of this measure and what we're overall gaining from it that's not being done now, and whether or not we here by this action are simply adding more to the planning burden and cost to local jurisdictions?
Chair Welsh, Representative Taylor. Goal 9 requires that this be done. I think that was, one, a criticism that was originally brought forward about the bill, but it was also something that we fully recognize. But as I said earlier, in most jurisdictions, the planning process that is occurring is usually done at an aggregate level, which doesn't take into consideration the size, type, or suitability or serviceability of the land. We believe that that puts jurisdictions in the long term at a disadvantage in that they are planning for certain things to occur but may not have the other infrastructural planning in place to assure that their growth projections are happening.
So, if I might interrupt, then you think this is something that cities and counties thought and want?
Chair Welsh, Representative Taylor, I would answer no to that question. We're working with the cities and the counties on our work group as regards this bill. There were comments made about the bill that this would require additional costs to local jurisdictions. We have trouble with that
question, given that Goal 9 requires that it be done. So if it, Goal 9 is being done at the local level, there should not be an associated cost with it. If the planning that is called out in Goal 9 is not being done, there would be additional costs to the jurisdiction, but we believe that that's a necessary cost given the importance of Goal 9 at the same level with other statewide planning goals.
Mr. Chair, Representative Taylor, according to LCDC, there are some jurisdictions that have had a greater level of compliance in terms of the specificity required by the Goal 9 rules than others. And so we're not suggesting that not all jurisdictions have not complied, but there are varying degrees of compliance. And so this was an effort to ensure that we would see, at least in the larger jurisdictions, the level of compliance in terms of specificity that helps ensure that they have the planning.
I have a city in my district that's over 25,000. So if it's still limited to that, I you know, this still doesn't affect me or the job I do here. My concern is that you are commercial real estate people, and I think your interest is self-interest, obviously, and I don't think you deny that. I just want to ask, what's in it for the cities and counties? What do they get out of it? What's positive for them?
I believe they get a better level of planning that assures that the land within the urban growth boundaries is better utilized. Again, and I sincerely believe that if you look at, again, page 2 and lines 10 through 16.
The A7 amendment.
Commercial real estate industry wants efficient land use. Commercial real estate industry wants to have certainty that there's a good relationship between the type of sites that are identified for employment growth actually have the level of services in place, or at least the plans in place, so that job attraction can continue. Yes, there is a self-interest here. We want job growth to occur. Our business is based on job growth. But we do believe that it's an efficient way to do it, and we believe that if the effort is made up front, the plan for land, plan for housing, and the relationship that mutually benefits the 250 pipes, we'll have a more efficient use of land, we'll have better development, and we'll have more economically feasible development and cost-beneficial development. So, again, I hope I answered your question without being too self-aware.
Just one more question. I guess, where is the problem? Is the problem that cities are not currently doing this? They're not currently planning for their economic, for the jobs-related part?
Sure, well, Representative Taylor. I think in some cases it's occurring. I think Clackamas County is a classic example of where we may have missed the boat and we need to do better planning. A number was given to me somewhere over 60 or 70% of people who live in Clackamas County do not work in Clackamas County, that we're in a job housing imbalance. I see emerging cities of 25,000 and over that, again, if they do the upfront work to make sure that they don't get into that position, it is a 20-year planning horizon. The bill allows periodic check-ins to calibrate, recalibrate the assumptions that went into the planning. For us, it's just good planning. If we would plan a good development and a good site and good building practices, we want to work with the community to plan for the potential for good development to occur, and so that we don't get situations, again, where we're driving and creating then infrastructural problems related to land use, transportation, water, sewer, energy, that is currently in effect in some jurisdictions or could be in effect in the future for a 20-year planning horizon in emerging states.
Just one last comment, if I might, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your indulgence. I don't mean to be argumentative, but in the southern part of Columbia County, with Scappoo, there are no way 25,000 people, but they have the problem that you're describing. They have a large commuter population. They lack the economic base. But this is not going to help them.
Mr. Chair, Representative Taylor, currently all jurisdictions are required to incorporate this employment economic planning and process in their comprehensive land use plan. Goal 9 applies right now to any jurisdictions. Problem being there again that in many jurisdictions it's more of an aggregate process rather than one looking at specific sites or suitability of sites.
And the chair wanted to close the work session on Senate Bill 87 and open a hearing on Senate Bill 87. And I see we have Representative Schrader with us. We'll let him come up and present his amendments. Welcome. We've got a long list here. I don't think we're going to get through it today before we go to the floor. So we'll have a hearing and bring this back probably on Friday.
I appreciate the chair's indulgence here, and I'll try and be rapid for those who are here to speak in that opportunity. For the record, my name is Bruce Schrader. I'm the state representative from District 23, and please have the opportunity to come here. I've been following the committee's work on this and the work group's work on Senate Bill 87 with a lot of interest, like some others, and have been generally pleased with the evolution in thought that seems to be represented here. In that they're trying to apparently strike a balance between what's good for the communities and what's been done in the past. And in so doing, as we get up to the A7s, trying to fine-tune the 20-year need, it's become apparent that the committee and the work group have come around to the thought that rather than basing things on a mere five-year recent phenomenon, we ought to look at the forecast. What's good for the community? We just heard testimony that and I think Representative Taylor brought up some good points about, you know, there have been some communities, Southern Oregon, on the coast, quite frankly, even in my district, have been left behind in the need for commercial industrial development. So there's jobs there for all the people that are living in those areas. And the idea of looking at the commercial industrial, I think, is very, very important. Should we base it on just what's happened in the past? I think the answer is obviously not. Otherwise, all the economic and business growth will happen in downtown Portland. It needs to occur in other communities. That's how we encourage growth and development. That's how we make this the state of Oregon, not just the Willamette Valley. So my amendments kind of look at the residential thing. If we're going this route here, trying to forecast what are the true needs, where do we need to have residential growth, I would suggest to the committee and members of the work group that we apply the same rationale, the same methodology that they've been working so hard over the last 3 months, the Senate Bill 87 to the residential arena. There are parts in my district where we've had a tremendous amount of residential growth, and we do not need to continue in that vein. We also need that commercial industrial base. If you look at the dash A8, which is the amendments that I presented, it merely reflects, I think, the evolution of thinking you're dealing with a commercial industrial. And the A7s on page 2, it just goes ahead and says, hey, geez, let's not base our growth rate on the 5 years most recent. Let's do the same forecasting. You know, where do we want to be? What is best for those communities? How do we achieve that jobs, housing balance that was just talked about? And we change it to the forecasting language that you've got kind of running through the dash A4s to the dash A7s, so it kind of piggybacks on the work, if you will, that the work group has already done. And then again on page 3, it basically looks at, all right, well, what are our basis of comparison and stuff? We do. Well, we use that 5 years, the preceding 5 years. Let's tailor that, take that into account, and adjust either up or down what the true needs for that community, how that community would most likely benefit, I think, in the long run. I guess I point out in closing to the committee that if we use just the last 5 years, that in the 1980s, we would have been, in many parts of the state of Oregon, confined to a very, very, very low substandard rate of growth for residential and commercial growth. And that would have really adversely affected how those urban growth boundaries and those comprehensive plans were initially developed, because most of them were developed in the mid-1980s. But fortunately, at that point in time, we were looking out and trying to figure out what are our long-term needs based on a 20-year horizon, not confined to just a restricted period of time for comparison. And fortunately, we've established some pretty good growth boundaries. It's taken a long time, 20 years almost, to come up against and have any problems. I just would ask the committee's indulgence and look hard at this. I think if you get some broad-based support for these types of amendments, then I think as we get near the end of the session, the idea is to gather support rather than polarize groups, and I feel that this sort of amendment would just add to the basic support that, and all the good work that the work group and the committee has done. Urge your support.
Any other questions, Mr. Eddy?
I'm sure, thank you. Representative, just to recap your intent here, what you're saying is on the residential side, rather than using the last 5 years, let's have a more flexible formula for looking ahead that envisions potential changes in strategy.
That is correct. Exactly the same rationale, I believe, that the work groups use for commercial investment.
Thank you.
Other questions? Thank you, Representative.
Thank you very much.
John Chandler.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, members of the committee. John Chandler, Director of Governmental Affairs for the Oregon Building Industry Association, here on Senate Bill 87, the -87 amendments and the -88. I don't believe I've testified on this bill in the House. I want to put on record that the Building Industry Association firmly supports Senate Bill 87. It builds on work that we began in 1995 with regard to forecasting needs for development inside of the Gulf boundaries and more efficient use of the land. The A7 amendments I have not been involved with. I believe they're a good improvement to the bill, and I would commend them to you. The -88 amendments, however, we oppose vigorously. And I, with all due respect to Representative Schrader, though he and I have had this conversation over the years, the distinction that is being made between commercial and residential, I think, is an appropriate one. I won't rehash what happened in the -87 amendments. The language being proposed for deletion in the A8, however, with the chair's indulgence, I'd like to give a little bit of history on that. When House Bill 2709 was brought forward in 1995, which is the language that's in front of you being deleted, one of the things that we were concerned with is there's two things both government needs to do when they're doing an urban growth boundary analysis. First thing they need to do is figure out what their land need is. How much land do they have? It's buildable. What can be done with it? Is it the right places and so forth? The second thing they need to do is look to the future and figure out what can we do differently? How can we continue that doing this right and so forth? The language that we put in the bill in 1995 is the proposal for deletion in the A8 amendment required a 5-year look back. And that didn't dictate the growth rate. It had nothing to do with the growth rate. That had to do with the actual density that's being built, the actual mix of housing that was being provided. And the reason we did that, and I remind the committee, that was the bill supported by the governor's office, LCDC, and on down the line. The reason we did that was very simple. We wanted to make sure that when jurisdictions did their needs analysis, they were basing it on facts, on what had happened, not on what they hoped to have happened. The hope-for piece would come as you look to the future and figure out strategies for accommodating growth. We're not trying to foreclose jurisdictions from being creative about density, being creative about housing types, or anything else. But we believe it's very important, and we believe then, we believe now, that it's critical that you base your need on what you know. And in the metro area, which is kind of the genesis of that bill in 1995, there's a great deal of discussion of basing a plan on densities that have never been achieved in the metropolitan area. We find, and still do, that that was a mistake. You should base your need analysis on what you know has happened. That's the point of your look back. Once you've done that, once you've seen, here's what we've actually built, here's what the market has actually accepted, here's what's actually occurred on the ground, then you can go, if that tells you you need more land in the boundary, or you don't have enough land for 20 years supply, then you can get creative, subject to the provisions of the law, about the likelihood of actually happening. But to take away the 5-year look back and to do as the A8 would propose, would allow jurisdiction to essentially avoid a significant portion of their responsibility, which is to assess where they are today. Because until you do that, you don't know where you're trying to get to in the future. I think there's a confusion between the need analysis and the projection into the future as far as what you do with that need analysis. That the A's kind of blurs, and I believe that leaving the language alone allows jurisdictions to do a better job. As a matter of fact, we're in discussions with the governor's office and BLCD about Metro again on this exact same problem, where the factors being used in the Metro area to determine whether or not the boundary should move, and if so, how much, are being based on hopes, not facts. And we think, as we did in 1995, that proper planning has its genesis in factual data and then extrapolates from that factual data towards the future that the community wants to achieve. I agree with Reverend Gostrader completely that committees should be allowed to pick how they want to grow, pick how they develop. Nothing in the law currently prohibits that. I think the deletion proposed in the AA amendments would significantly complicate the planning process at the local level. I would encourage you, in closing, to adopt the A7 and to talk about the A8. I'll be glad to take any questions you might have.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Chandler, what I understand you saying, as I'm looking at the laws that exist now, a local government has two options. One is they can base the amount of land they're going to incorporate on the densities that were built over the former 5 years, or they can develop new measures that increase the density that is likely to be expected and can base the amount of land they're going to bring in based on those new measures. Is that correct?
Reverend Murphy, let me recast it. What the local governments do now is they take a look based on a 5-year window, and that's what they've done. They have a forecast, and the word forecast isn't used in the current law. It's based on what they do. They get a hold of a smart growth report in state or someplace and figure out what the growth patterns are going to be for their community. Then they take the lands that they've identified that they have, the buildable lands that are available, apply that to the growth rate and figure out whether or not they have enough land to accommodate the growth that's being projected. That's the first thing they do. Then they have three choices, essentially. They then can, if they don't have enough land left, if they have plenty of land, if they have plenty of land supply, then they're done, they go have a cup of coffee. If there isn't plenty of land supply, then they have three choices. They can either expand the boundary, or they can adopt measures to increase density and more efficient use, or they can do a combination. Most jurisdictions that have toyed with this, frankly, with the exception of the metro area, have found they already have a 20-year land supply, so we haven't really encountered it. But my guess is, and the assumption of the working group put the bill together in 1995 was that the primary answer would be both. That there'd be some boundary move, there'd be some increased density. But the increased density, and the point I was trying to make earlier, is driven off of what actually occurred. And you don't know what you need until you know until you have actually done that analysis based on the facts. Then how do you deal with those facts in terms of if you've been doing half-acre development and you want to do quarter-acre development, that's part of your plan to increase density. Or if you've been doing 5,000 square foot lots and you want to go down to row houses, that's part of your plan. But to base your need on the row houses you're going to do that you haven't done yet is a mistake. And that's why the language in the law is there, to make sure that we actually get a good snapshot before that jurisdiction year.
Mm-hmm.
Without precluding whatever measure they choose to take in the future to make sure to increase the efficient use of the land.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Where's
all the
list? How many good ones?
I don't think this dynamic is as clear in the metropolitan area because it's, quite honestly, so large. But in some of these other cities that are, say, 30,000 people or Salem, Salem is now about 120, I think. If they base it on their past experience in their previous 5, and they're trying to go to a direction to better utilize the land, but because they're basing it on their past 5 and they haven't had a good experience, and they end up expanding the boundary, do they reduce the capability to follow through with their plans? I mean, in the metropolitan area, it's a little bit different because it is so large. But clearly, the housing market has changed dramatically in the last 10 or 15 years. Infill development that would have never been considered when I was a city councilor is occurring all over the place. Small lot subdivisions, which I would have been strung up for approving when I was a city councilor, are being approved all over the place. To what extent is that dynamic there in a smaller community? I mean, particularly when you get to the even smaller than Salem, but you get a 30,000 person community. So you're forcing them, in a sense, by now analyzing the last 5 years, which they've done a good job to expand the boundary, then they don't have the pressures really to try to better utilize the land that's within the boundary. I mean, it's a hypothetical. I leave a big opening, so.
Member, I'm very glad you asked that question, actually, because I think there's an assumption being made in the question that deserves to be discussed, and that is that the mere act of moving the boundary takes pressure off. It does to a certain extent in the fact, particularly in the metro area, for example, where you've had, in some areas, close to panic buying and selling based on a perception of scarcity. But the urban growth boundary is a tool, and only one tool that determines urban development. The mere fact that land is added doesn't mean you get subdivision planned on the next day, as you well know. There's service restrictions, all possible, the delivery issue, there's the zoning issue, there's all sorts of other tools that local government has. The reason that the 5-year look back is important, and there's nothing magic about 5 years, that was picked because it avoided market fluctuation. But the issue there is we have a small town of 30,000 people that have done a good job. If they want to do a better job, that's commendable, and everybody, I think, will support that. But they need to understand where they are at the time they start doing that better job, which is what the 5-year look back gives them. It doesn't mean they have to continue developing that data. In fact, we're very careful in the law that they have the ability to go forward with different more aggressive planning. But what it does say is that as of that moment, here's where you're at. Excuse me, as a gang of a preposition or something, part of some jersey. That's where you are today. Now, if you want to improve that, you work off of that base towards the future. But the fact in front of them is that up to that point, that's what the development pattern is being, whatever it is, 1/4 acre lots, 5 acre lots, 2 acre lots. So what we were trying to avoid with this was jurisdictions who decided, we're going to do a better job, we're going to base our plan on townhomes. And the jurisdictions who have never seen a townhome, that would be a mistake in all likelihood because it probably wouldn't happen, at least not to the level necessary to maintain the housing market. But the 5-year, it's important to understand that the 5-year analysis dictates absolutely nothing about the future other than where the future starts. The jurisdiction is completely free to go forward, and if the boundary moves based on that analysis, that doesn't by itself mean that that development is going to occur at the same level. The jurisdiction, as you know, from the council says, has the ability to put in minimum densities, and the law lists out a number of options available to local government that could dictate the way development occurs. Basically, what you're doing, I think, when you're looking at that, is you're hedging your bets somewhat. Because if the boundaries become too tight, then the land supply becomes scarce. If the demand remains constant, the price goes up. That's given. What you're doing with this look back is assuming that we're going to do a better job, but we're not going to punish ourselves at the front end in case we don't make it. We're going to make sure we have land available in case that the best we're able to do is a slight modification of the present. And then if a jurisdiction is able to turn it around and go to a much more compact lot pattern or a more multifamily or, then the land would not be needed in the next 5-year analysis. They would not have a boundary issue in front of them.
Okay. Any other questions? Bring Bob Rindy and maybe Lori. She'll let me know. Looks like a lane. No. Is it lane? Okay.
The chairman of the committee, I'm Bob Rindy with the Department of Land Conservation and Development, and with me is Lainey Smith, also from the department. And we're here, I think, more to respond to your questions than to testify either for or against this bill. We testified on the Senate side that the principles of the bill are not different than those which we have been using. We were concerned about the language in the bill and some technical details, and we did, with the help of the governor's office and others, establish a work group and have gone through most of those details, all of those details, and I think we've reached agreement on most points. There are still, I think, some sticking points that you may hear of. But because of the work that everybody's done in the work group on this, the department is, at this point, we are not opposed to the bill. We think those concerns have been taken care of. We are, indeed, neutral on this bill at this point. Lainey has worked on most of these details, and so we'll stop here and just see whether you have some some questions. I don't know if you have some additional remarks.
Yes, Elaine, is the last conceptual that we ran out on the dash 7 that were on under section 2 and then over on 4, is that addressing more of the concerns that the department had, or is that coming out of some of the other members of the work group?
It's a combination. All along we've been addressing the concerns of the department, and then we've been drafting additional language in that this last batch of amendments that came in, that is now -87 responds to discussion among the work group members, and it's still consistent with what we were concerned about addressing on that.
Okay. Let's move Devlin. How would you foresee this working in the metropolitan area in terms of, I'd say part of the testimony, hopefully I didn't misunderstand, but it's when Metro made their considerations, they were looking at the metropolitan area as a whole. How specific jurisdictionally could they come with these criteria in terms of differences between communities? And I have communities within the metropolitan area, some of which have a good mix of industrial, commercial, residential, some that are largely simply residential and chosen to be largely residential. How do you see this working in terms of their local comprehensive plans that they still have to go through periodic review on, in terms of sometimes the assumptions made that, you know, industrial outside my district, you know, for example, Tualatin has a significant amount of industrial uses and industrial land. Has a modest amount of commercial and a large amount of residential. Lake Oswego has large amounts of residential and office, but very little industrial. West Lynn is practically all residential and has only a modest amount of commercial and almost an invisible amount of industrial. How much can those communities accommodate their future desires and other communities like them? Hillsborough has more industrial than anybody in practically the metropolitan area.
Chair Welsh, Devlin, this bill gives direction to Metro on forecasting industrial and commercial lands and planning for it. It's up to Metro through the functional plan to work with the local jurisdictions to deal with those issues of balance within the region. This bill does not specifically address.
So, Mr. Chairman, so they could still work out their individual differences and desires within this bill.
That's it.
Would you say that, Mr. Chairman, that would be the same in some of the other areas like Springfield, Eugene? I'm not familiar with the differences there, or if you took the whole district there, the whole area of Medford to Ashland and the communities in there, could they do the same thing?
Chair Welsh, Representative.
Too much industrial land in Ashland, quite honestly.
This bill only applies to cities that are 25,000 or more, or urban areas of 25,000 or more. So
you can make it Medford Woods, probably.
Right. In an area like Eugene Springfield, where there's two cities within one urban growth boundary, they would be working together to forecast and accommodate the commercial industrial needs for their area, and so it wouldn't necessarily be that each city would have to balance it for itself. The legislation isn't requiring that.
Mr. Chairman, just if they were following this as being represented to us, even cities under 25,000 would be making some of these projections and determining what they need for exactly.
Correct.
Mm-hmm.
Do you agree with the components of the bill that this measure will facilitate infilling by planning jurisdictions?
Chair Welsh, Representative Taylor, I think that the bill has some good language in it that instructs local jurisdictions to look at efficiency of land use, compact development, mixed use. And so I think it takes us a step further in that direction than we have been before.
Other questions? Thank you very much. Mary Kyle McCurdy.
Good morning, Chair Welsh, members of the committee. My name is Mary Kyle McCurdy, representing 1,000 Friends of Oregon. We've opposed the original Senate Bill 87 and testified to that effect before you. We are unsure still about the need for this bill. We have a fundamental problem there that we are unsure of the need. And again, today, hearing from the proponents, it sounds like the issue is enforcement of the existing Goal 9. Not a need for new statute. And there are procedures in place for enforcing Goal 9 if a local jurisdiction is not properly accommodating or conforming to that goal. We have concerns that by putting the language in statute, we're creating unnecessary rigidity. We currently have language along these lines in the Goal 9 and in the implementing rule to Goal 9, and the Land Conservation Development Commission has expressed its intent to do further rulemaking on Goal 9, and our preference would be to work out the issues that have been raised by the proponents in that rulemaking, and at best to keep this bill very general, and we're concerned that it's too rigid at this point. As the proponents have described, Metro and other jurisdictions are now undergoing this kind of analysis, and we would prefer to learn from that process that's taking place at Metro right now, and incorporate what we've learned from that into revised rules as opposed to putting it in state statute, which is more rigid in rulemaking. Nonetheless, we have been meeting with the bill's proponents, and I compliment them on the work that they've done and the lengths to which they've gone to accommodate our concerns. We've been seeing if we could develop a bill on which we could be neutral. We've had long discussions as recently as last Thursday on this, and however, we, as you, have just seen the amendments reflecting those discussions, so it's difficult for me to comment on them in detail today. We would still, although in the back of the room going through it, Mr. Cross suggested one amendment that we are concerned about and that we agree with, and I'd like to suggest a couple of others on page 2 of the bill at lines 5 through 7. We are concerned, again, with the rigidity of the language, sizes, types, and location of retail, office, and industrial development. Those may or may not be the correct factors to measure for retail versus industrial versus commercial. For example, I can see that that makes more sense for industrial, but not necessarily for retail or office use. And if this is going to instruct LCDC on rulemaking, we prefer more general language along the lines of examining existing and projected trends for land suitable to meet the needs forecast in subsection 2. Again, we're concerned about having rigid language in state statute. Also, a technical issue on page 3, at lines 5 through 9, this section refers to performance measures, and we support adopting performance measures. But subsection B at lines 8 and 9 has, in this version, it's just written by legislative counsel, is not actually a performance measure. It's awkward. I think a technical fix can be made to it. I don't have language right now, but what's described there is not actually a performance measure. Regarding the amendments offered by Representative Schrader to the residential aspects of existing law, we fully support those. And I want to try to respond to some of the questions that came up on that issue. Current law does allow a local jurisdiction to base its urban growth boundary expansion on its last 5 years of development. It also allows it to try to do better in the future than it has in the past, but it's not required to. And I can tell from personal experience currently in a jurisdiction that's at 25,000 in population, that if we are dragging them, kicking and screaming to try to do better in the future on residential than they have in the past. And to remove that from existing law and require them to base their UGB expansion needs on forecasted needs is a great improvement over existing law. If we simply base the future on our past 5 years, there are jurisdictions that probably would not zone land for multifamily, row houses, duplexes, and a variety of other small lot housing opportunities that our changing demographic population is demanding. We've seen that where jurisdictions have allowed those to occur, they have been the hottest product on the market. And we would like to see jurisdictions really be required to plan for the future based on the future, not allow them to plan for the future based on the past. Briefly, to respond to something Representative Devlin asked previous speakers regarding how would this work in Eugene, Springfield, or a region like that, and or Medford, I think that was the example that you used. While this applies to cities of 25,000 and over, in the bill, the forecasted need on page 1, lines 13 through 19, is supposed to be based on a regionally coordinated 20-year forecast of retail services, office, blah, 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 blah. We, in our discussions, have expected that a regionally coordinated 20-year forecast in Medford, for example, would look at the entire Rogue Valley, that it would have to look at Ashland and Talent and Phoenix and Central Point, et cetera, and coordinate its regional needs with those needs in the region, and we expect that rulemaking would better define what regions is. And I think that that's something we've all agreed on, and that's that would be our expectation.
Mr. Chair, I want to ask you about your comments on A8. I'm having a little trouble getting my hands around the distinction. Under current law, the jurisdiction has the ability to base the amount of lands on a forecast based on the last 5 years or a plan based on changes in the planned styles of residential development. How ultimately does that really distinguish between what's proposed in A8, which basically also gives ability to the jurisdiction to use a alternate vision of how land will be developed over the coming years? I mean, both provide that opportunity. How does this make it any more likely that a jurisdiction would seize that opportunity?
Chair Walsh, Representative Merkley, as I read the A8, which I also just saw this morning, so I hope I'm interpreting it correctly, and perhaps Representative Schrader is still in the room.
I'd welcome Representative Schrader to also
As I read them on page 2 at lines 16 through 24, it removes the ability to amend a UGB to include sufficient buildable land, and then in the bracketed portion, to meet the needs of the actual developed density during the period since the last periodic review or during the last 5 years. So it takes out the ability to amend the UGB based on actual developed densities over the last 5 years, and instead says the UGB shall be amended to include sufficient buildable lands to accommodate the forecast housing need, not the past 5 years. And current law does provide cities the opportunity to expand their UGBs based on changes to their plans and codes to demonstrably increase the likelihood that they'll use land more efficiently in the future than they have in the past. But it doesn't require them to do so. It allows them to expand the UGB based on the past 5 years of development. This would not allow them to expand the UGB based on the last 5 years of development. It would have to be based on the forecast for housing needs, which may be significantly different than the last 5 years have been.
Comment. Yeah, I think contrary to what was testified to earlier by other parties, if you look carefully on page 2 of the dash 8 and the B that's being deleted up there, currently fast-growing jurisdictions have to basically build their forecast. If you read B there and then you look down at 4, what the recommendations are or how they're supposed to accommodate the B above, it requires them to amend their urban growth boundary based on last periodic review or growth rate of the last 5 years. And conceivably, in certain jurisdictions, that could be abnormally high, or it could be abnormally low based on the historic trends. Plus, it could be in contravention with what their forecasted needs and desires are to have that balanced, livable community. So what the amendments in the AA do is take out that artificial constraint only on 5 years. I argue that's not, a 5-year span does not take out the historic ups and downs. And that's not good for the community. In my area, the Willamette Valley, the residential rate has been excessive. And small towns under 25,000, such as Canby, have fallen under this current rubric. It should not be in statute this way. If we are truly trying to do good land use planning, because this discriminates against southern Oregon towns or eastern Oregon towns that have not grown at a fast rate. So contrary to what you heard, it is locked in. You must grow at that higher rate if you've been growing at a higher rate. It becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy in terms of ever-increasing that urban growth boundary or just residential. And I would argue that there are a lot of communities that need more of the business commercial, as you're hearing basically on the main portion of this entire bill. This is an attempt to balance that all out and make sure that it is actually development that's good and balanced for the community.
Mr. Chair, you've raised a point that I hadn't encountered before. As I was looking at this, it seemed to me that it says, look back over the last 5 years to see the style and mix and density, but I don't see it saying, look back over the last 5 years for the growth rate and extend or project that growth rate in the future. My understanding was that in terms of the growth rate, that was based much more upon a variety if you will, population analyses for that region. And I think the point you're making is a new one to me. I don't see it embedded in this language. So I guess I'm asking, is it embedded in this language that the growth rate of the last 5 years is projected?
Mr. Chair, Representative Merkley. Actually, yes. I haven't served in the Planning Commission for 16 years when this language was first passed in 1995. The immediate response by my planners was to say, oh, geez, you know, we need to adjust our comprehensive plan because we've been growing at such a high rate and we've had to increase the density. The density is directly related to the growth rate. You have to increase the mix of housing, more of the apartment types, more of the townhouse types to accommodate that growth rate. So one leads directly to the other. And the idea here, quite frankly, is with that linkage in mind, is that what's best for these communities? And so if the city planners, despite what the maybe the original intent of the people in 1995 putting this into statute was that say, well, it's just an academic density level, it's an average mix of housing, it doesn't have anything to do with population rate, that's not how it's being interpreted. And I would suggest once again that if we're looking, this committee now, 4 years later, is looking at an evolution of thought, seeing how it's actually happened in practice. And if you're going to use that forecasting language with commercial industrial, again, it only makes sense now that everyone's bought into the fact we have to plan for the future 20 or 40 year plan to place it here in Metro, so we should change the language for sure.
Okay. Thank you very much. Bob Clay.
Chair Welch, the members of the committee, Bob Clay, City Planner with City of Portland Planning Bureau, representing the City of Portland this morning. Notwithstanding a lot of work and time that's gone into the Dash 7 amendments today and a number of work sessions, work group sessions that have occurred and a number of hearings, the City of Portland today must still oppose Senate Bill 87, the Dash 7 amendment. We've participated in all the hearings and all the work group sessions convened by the Governor's Office and supported by the Department of Land Conservation and Development Commission. We appreciate the good work that's been done by the staff, both from the Governor's Office and from the Department. We think that the bill has come a long, long ways from where it was when it was on the House side. It's significantly different, and there have been many, many improvements, and the sponsors of the bill have responded to many of the concerns that have been raised. We appreciate the work by the sponsors and their responsiveness to those concerns that have been raised. We still have concerns. We have the concerns that about placing this level of detail, the statutory language, and then directing the commission, the LCD, to go ahead and do rulemaking with this level of detail. We would have preferred that if there is a problem, if there is a need to address this issue, that there had been
a more general directive requesting the department to do rulemaking in this area, rather than try to just get a few people together and put this level of detail directing the department to do the kinds of rulemaking at this level of detail that they'll be obligated to put in administrative rules. That's our basic concern right now. We again still come back to the question about what problem the bill is trying to address. As I think I mentioned before in my earlier testimony when I testified, that the City of Portland has participated with Metro in the work of the Urban Growth Management Functional Plan. We've done that over the last 2 years. We've done all of our analysis. We've developed databases. We've met with the requirements of the Growth Management Plan. We think that has accomplished the needs that were set out by Metro, that were understood by the Metro Council and our own City Council and Planning Commission. So we're a little still frustrated that we're still here debating that we need more information, better information. We're in agreement that we can always have better information, that we can develop better databases, but we're unsure why this level of detail to go into statute. Thank you. If you have to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Art Schlein.
Members of the committee, my name is Archie Mark. I'm with the Association of Oregon Counties, and I too was a member of the work group that met for probably the last month trying to address a number of issues with regard to Senate Bill 87. A lot of work was done, a lot of issues were discussed. Unfortunately, at this point, the Association of Oregon Counties cannot support Senate Bill 87 either. One issue that was raised early on the Senate side, and has also been something that's been raised in all our discussions, is the fact that when we look at this, we see an unfunded mandate. We see a major 30 impact that because of this, these provisions that we put in statute, local governments will be required to amend their comprehensive plans and implementing ordinances to put in additional measures than what we're required to do now. In essence, what Senate Bill 87 will require is local governments to conduct market studies. And basically, we will be doing market studies for commercial, industrial, and retail commercial activities based on our comprehensive plans and the forecasts. And then that information will be available to the industry, and I can assure you they will use it. We're concerned about language that talks about the sizes, types, and locations of commercial and breaking that down between retail and office uses, and also as it relates to light industrial. I've been a planner since, I hate to tell you, 1969 in the state of Oregon with a small respite in the state of Washington. We have encouraged mixed uses when it relates to commercial and industrial activity. It is almost very, very seldom do you see a commercial zone that does not allow office commercial activity, or an office zone that does not allow some retail, or a light industrial zone that doesn't allow either as an outright use of professional offices and some retail activities. So when we look at requirements to determine the needs and the forecasting of these types of activities, the idea of mixed use, I submit to you, will come to an end, and that we will have to do exclusionary zoning, and we will have to track, local governments will have to track how much land they have available for office use, for retail use, and for different industrial uses, rather than to bringing those together in what we've encouraged is a mixed use fashion. This bill, I submit to you, does not really foster mixed use development. One other issue is that as we look at the bill and the rules that will follow from it, we believe that we're putting together in another situation where we would have one size fits all. This bill is patterned after what Metro is doing. It's not required, but it's what they're doing. And we're saying we're going to take that outline, and we're going to apply it to the other cities or urban growth areas of 25 more. We continue to, the Association of Urban Counties has been concerned about one size fits all, and we express that concern with respect to this piece. Finally, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, would note that recently the Senate Bill 543 has been passed. I believe it will be going to the House floor in the very near future. Senate Bill 543 modifies the periodic review requirement. And in that bill, there's a provision that provides a much closer tie between the Economic Development Department and the periodic review and the LCDC. And I guess looking at that and the ability of Goal 9, the administrative rule that is on the books now, and the fact that EDD will be a much more active player because of Senate Bill 543, I would seriously question the need for Senate Bill 87. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'll conclude my remarks and answer questions.
I think the conceptuals removed from that sub 3, the size, types, and location of retail office and industrial, and replace it with suitable.
Mr. Chair,
is that what you were referring
that's
to?
That's part
of it.
Chair, that's part of it. However, on page 2, lines 5 and 6, there is also reference. So while this deals with it, if we were to deal with suitable and also in that on page 2, certainly that would be an improvement. I do note that there has been improvements in the bill from what we were looking at on the Senate side.
So I do plan on bringing this bill back up on Friday, so the work group will refer to the Dash 8 and Schrader's concerns and bring him into that group and talk with him on that. We'll ask some questions about that on Friday and bring it back. Anytime, I think we better get to the floor. Close the hearing on Senate Bill 87. House Bill 3456 will be back up on Friday also. So we'll have no further business today. We'll adjourn.